This is Patrick Wanna, celebrity life coach, human behavior expert, and clinical hypnotherapist, PhD. Is America the most medicated nation on earth? And if so, why? Is it that we all have something wrong with our brain? Well, according to data just released by the Department of Health and Human Services, America is probably the most medicated nation on earth. This data shows that at least half of all Americans takes at least one prescription drug, with one in six taking three or more medications. In 2007, antidepressants became the most prescribed drug in the U.S. Now, some doctors believe this is a positive sign that people are finally seeking help for their issues, but others disagree, saying that this shows that people are becoming too dependent on antidepressants. At the same time, in its study, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention looked at 2.4 billion drugs prescribed in visits to doctors and hospitals in the year 2005. Of those, 118 million were antidepressants. So again, the question remains, why are we so depressed? Is it that we all suffer from a chemical balance, an organic disorder? Is there something wrong with our brain? Well, Dr. Peter Breggin has been called the conscience of psychiatry because of his efforts to reform the mental health field. This includes his promotion of caring psychotherapeutic approaches and his opposition to the escalating overuse of psychiatric medications. Also, the oppressive diagnosing and drugging of children, electroshock, lobotomy, voluntary treatment, and false biological theories. Dr. Breggin is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist and former full-time consultant at NIMH. He has a private practice in New York where he treats adults, couples, and families with children. He also offers consultations in clinical psychopharmacology and often acts as a medical expert in criminal malpractice and product liability suits. He's an author of numerous books and scientific articles, including his newest, Medication Madness, A Psychiatrist Exposes the Dangers of Mood-Altering Medications. Dr. Breggin.
Let me clarify that I'm in Ithaca, New York.
Okay, so do we all have something wrong with our brain?
Well, we all have brains, and brains struggle. Human beings struggle, but the problem isn't within the brain itself. The problem is in the complexity of human life and in the complexity of the stresses that we face growing up and then living in the world, and the stresses of having existential choices and conflicting values. The human life has always been difficult from recorded history. As early as anybody was writing, they were writing about life being difficult, people having challenges and problems to deal with. It's only in recent times that drug company propaganda has convinced people that these challenges that we all face in life are actually merely a matter of our own biochemical imbalances, and if we got our biochemicals balanced, somehow we'd be able to sail through these challenges.
Are you saying to me and everyone listening that there is no such thing as chemical imbalance, that there is no such thing as an organic disorder, that a person depressed isn't suffering from a chemical imbalance?
As far as we know, the people who routinely come to psychiatrists, psychologists, and counselors for help feeling anxious or depressed or even very, very disturbed have absolutely nothing wrong in their brains. In fact, we wouldn't even be able to measure a biochemical imbalance in the living human brain. The concept is entirely a PR campaign, and perhaps one of the most successful in the history of the world, where the drug companies set out, along with organized psychiatry, convince people that if they're troubled or even desperate, that it's a biochemical issue, not a life issue, and they've been very successful.
Well, indeed they have. Now, I must at this juncture say that I do agree with you, and based on all my work with clients, I agree with you 100%. But we still have to look at this point. If you're saying there is no such thing as a chemical imbalance, then what about all the studies and reports that have been put out by these major pharmaceuticals?
Well, actually, there aren't studies and reports proving a biochemical imbalance in the brain. It's just advertising. If you go on their websites, they'll say something like, thought to be caused by a biochemical imbalance or may be caused by a biochemical imbalance.
All right, hold on. You're telling me that there is no scientific proof that shows that if a person is depressed, there is a chemical imbalance in his brain or body?
No, there's absolutely none whatsoever, no.
All right, so how is this lie being propagated?
Well, it's very straightforward. Much of it starts with Prozac. Eli Lilly, the manufacturer of Prozac, has been clever to the point at times of outright negligence, as I describe in Medication Madness. And even before Prozac was approved by the FDA, Eli Lilly was sending out doctors to convince other doctors and the public that biochemical imbalances were the cause of depression, and that in particular a serotonin imbalance caused depression. And all of this was a PR buildup for the eventual approval and then marketing of Prozac. And incidentally, they were not even able to show that Prozac was really effective in the FDA trials. They ended up giving a lot of the patients tranquilizers to calm them down. Most of the trials didn't show any effectiveness. And the drug, as I argued in earlier books and continue to point out in Medication Madness, Prozac probably shouldn't have been approved in the first place.
All right. Well, there's obviously a lot of important points and a lot of other important questions that I wish to ask, including the FDA's role and how they've come to approve so many of these medications. But first, let's go back to this very important point, probably the most important point, of does a chemical imbalance exist or not exist in the human brain? What about the brain scans that show different kind of activity in the brain of someone that's suffering from depression?
Well, first, let me make a few points about this. First of all, there aren't any consistent brain scans showing any differences in the brains of anybody with psychiatric disorders other than the changes caused by psychiatric medication. For example, people who take antidepressants do develop abnormal growth of brain cells, and in some cases there are scans showing shrinkage of brain tissue.
I've got to jump in here. You're telling me that the people that take antidepressants actually end up suffering from physical damage to the brain?
Yeah, there are a number of studies now that confirm that not only are there persistent and probably permanent biochemical changes, but studies are also showing abnormal cell growth. And so distorted in their thinking are the drug company advocates that they're now claiming that it's good for you to have abnormal cell growth from taking antidepressants. If you were getting abnormal cell growth from drinking alcohol or smoking marijuana, you can bet they wouldn't be saying it was a good or normal thing.
Who is saying it's good and normal?
Well, actually, in Medication Madness, I cited Johns Hopkins press release that went along with a study showing abnormal cellular growth in the brains of adults taking Prozac and animals taking Prozac. It was animals taking Prozac.
On what basis are they saying that this is good?
They make it up. They've done the same thing with children. They have shown that there has been shrinkage in some parts of the brains of children taking antidepressants, and they claim, well, the kids had too large an area to start with. This is all quite bizarre, but very, very well documented in really two of my books, Medication Madness, which is a book that tells a lot of detailed life stories of how people have been harmed and driven into madness by the psychiatric drugs, and provide some scientific background. And in the same year, 2008, this year also, my medical book was updated, Brain Disabling Treatments and Psychiatry. And in Brain Disabling Treatments and Psychiatry, I go into particular depth in looking at the studies showing abnormal brain growth, the poisoning of brain cells, and so on by pretty much the whole range of psychiatric drugs, antidepressants, mood stabilizers, neuroleptic drugs. I mean, they're all scientific studies that I'm citing. There are a whole range of studies now showing that psychiatric drugs, pretty much in every category, are neurotoxic. That is, they poison brain cells. One of the manifestations that come up in multiple studies are abnormal growth of cells. They get distorted, elongated, they get too many branches. Other studies show in children, antidepressants causing shrinkage in some areas of the brain. And other studies show just a variety of not only biochemical and functional changes, but anatomical changes. This is true with the mood stabilizers as well, and it's also true with the antipsychotic drugs that we are now giving more and more to children, like Risperdal and Zyprexa. So there's no question that psychiatric drugs cause brain dysfunction and brain damage, and that a lot of it is going to be persistent. And I review these scientific studies in a lot of detail in my book, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, that came out earlier this year. And then I give the case illustrations, the stories of people driven into madness by psychiatric drugs, in a book that just came out this week called Medication Madness.
If you're saying that these drugs are actually causing physical damage to the brain, what are the long-term effects of this? Well, obviously the permanent ones are obvious, but what about the other ones? What are the long-term effects of the use of these drugs?
Well, they probably vary from category to category. The antidepressants clinically are producing dependence, so that the changes in the brain are substantial enough that people can't stop taking the drugs. They go into withdrawal. And that's something we need to warn people about who are listening to what I'm saying. As frightening as it is to take drugs and these psychiatric drugs, as dangerous it is, it's also dangerous to quickly withdraw from them. So you need to withdraw from them in a careful way, hopefully with really good, experienced clinical supervision. But the longer-term effects with the antidepressants seem to be, in good part, a production of apathy and indifference. People start to care less and less, to feel less and less. With the antipsychotic drugs, you get a great deal of deterioration overall of the mental functions. And with lithium, you get loss of memory, and you get problems with concentration and focus over time. We don't have good studies long-term of the effects of Ritalin. We tend to want to not look at that in terms of the long-term mental effects, but we do know that there are persistent biochemical changes that can be detected in the brains of animals given the stimulants like Ritalin and Adderall and amphetamine. We also know that the children become prone as young adults to use cocaine. There's an increased rate of cocaine abuse because the brain has been changed. That's a reflection of the permanent change. We also know that growth is stunted, height and weight. Well, if you're stunting growth, and it's not just loss of appetite, you're actually stunting growth by disrupting growth hormone, you know, one worries about what those effects are going to have on the brain as well.
Dr. Bregan, if we automatically assume, and I'm asking this question for a reason, that everything you say is true, and I have no reason to doubt it because in your books you cite medical studies, then we must ask the question, why is the FDA okay with this? Why is the government okay with this? And why are the people okay with this?
Well, to start with the heart of the matter, it's a multi-billion dollar industry that has basically become a partnership between organized psychiatry and medicine and the multi-billion dollar industry. In psychiatry, for example, all the journals are supported by advertising from the drug companies. Many of the journals are sent free to doctors by the drug companies. The conferences are supported by the drug companies. 90% of the research is supported by the drug companies. Professorships, even whole buildings on medical school campuses are paid for by the drug companies. So you have now a medical profession which is indistinguishable, unfortunately, from the pharmaceutical industry. On the other side is the fact that human beings have forever found life very difficult and very painful, and understandably have sought shortcuts and solutions to these problems. But in the past, we have tended to see this as a weakness, as something we shouldn't be doing. That if you were going to take drink alcohol to solve your problems or smoke marijuana, that this was not a good idea. and that even taking psychiatric drugs should be done very cautiously and hardly at all or not at all with children. So human beings, even though they've had a tendency to want solutions to suffering, to emotional, psychological, spiritual suffering, have looked askance at drugs in general. But this enormous amount of propaganda coming from the drug industry and then through places like the National Institute of Mental Health, the FDA, even the U.S. Department of Education has promoted the ADHD diagnosis and the use of psychiatric drugs. People begin to believe that, hey, these somewhat easy-sounding solutions are actually scientifically valid. You get this explosive combination of the false advertising from this giant, what I call, psychopharmaceutical complex and the desperation and needs of human beings.
All right, so then what do you say, that ADHD does not exist? And if so, what is it really?
Well, focusing on children, ADHD, by definition, is a collection of behaviors that annoy teachers and demand attention.
Well,
I mean, no, it's really true. That's not even an exaggeration. If you actually look at them, for example, I'll read a couple for you. Here, under inattention, these are diagnostic behaviors. Often fails to give close attention to details or makes careless mistakes in schoolwork. Well, of course, that's the kind of thing that requires some teaching and some attention from parents as well, maybe. Then under hyperactivity, often fidgets with hands or feet or squirms in seat. That's another thing where, you know, a teacher really ought to be paying a little more attention, getting the child's interest. Often leaves seat in classroom. I mean, all of these are from the diagnostic manual. All these things are tailored to give teachers an excuse for pushing medication. My favorite one is under impulsivity, because I've already done this to you today. Often blurts out answers before questions have been completed. That's me.
I do that for effect.
Yeah, well, you know, and I do it.
Maybe I need ADHD drugs.
You know, the point is that if a child has these problems, let's even say it reaches a proportion where it's a problem, a child's always jumping up in class and disrupting the classroom, is that a disease? No, it has no known biological origin, nor is it likely to have one, because it's such an odd collection of behaviors, all of which relate to disrupting classrooms. That's how they would develop. What it could be is almost anything. It can be a boring teacher. I have seen cases of, quote, ADHD cured by a change of teacher. Could be boring classroom curriculum. Could be the child is just never going to want to sit in a room for the rest of their lives of 25 people and listen to somebody go on and on. Few adults ever put up with the conditions that we expect our kids to put up with in a classroom. Could be the child's hungry. Could be the child has a problem of a physical nature, head injury, fatigue, not sleeping enough, diabetes. You know, anything. If this really becomes a real problem where a kid is having trouble controlling his behavior, concentrating, and so on and so forth, come from almost anything on the face of the earth. Now, the cases that come to me, the kids that come to me, generally fall into two categories. If they have a problem at home, it's called a discipline problem. I don't approach it like a disease. I approach it, hey, parents, let's get a consistent plan for unconditional love and reasonable discipline. And I guarantee the parents that if they apply this, the children will do well. Or if the problem's at school and, say, not at home, then you look to the school. What does the teacher need to do? What does the school need to do? And sometimes parents just simply have to bite the bullet and homeschool or send the child to another school. But under no conditions should we accept this hodgepodge list as a disease, and we should never medicate the children. All psychiatric drugs can do is disrupt brain function. That's a central thesis of my work. You'll find it in Medication Madness. They disrupt mental function, and they spellbind the victim. That is, the child or adult who's taking a medication is being partially mentally disabled by it, but doesn't know it, can't appreciate it. You can see that with people who drink alcohol. You know, they don't really appreciate what's happening to them. Quite often.
Right. So you're raising two very important points. One is, a person comes into an office a professional's office with a problem. They walk out with a prescription and a label and no real solution to the problem, but rather a medication which will then create more problems, some of which could be long-term permanent damage. Meanwhile, the original cause of these symptoms has not been attended to in any way whatsoever, which is what I mean to be the second problem or the second point. When you talk about ADD and ADHD, and you've cited some of your own examples, based on my expertise in human behavior, I always go back to the emotions, because our behavior is simply a reflection of our thoughts, feelings, attitudes, and beliefs. And based on some of my experience, I found that kids who are, as you even put it, impulsive, or who scream out for attention, who can't focus, can't concentrate, tend to have had very little attention at home, or tend to receive little attention from father. Now,
I'm with you 100%. I've actually coined the term DADD, Dad Attention Deficit Disorder, because that's what a lot of the kids are suffering from.
Well, it's interesting you say that, Dr. Bergen, because I live by the beach and I'm by the pool the other day, and there is an 11-year-old girl, the daughter of a friend, who just jumps and clings, and the mother says, I go crazy because, you know, I can't control her. And obviously she's always trying to get attention from me. And I said to her immediately, and she said, the doctors tell me that she's got ADD and ADHD. I said, no, I just bet she doesn't get enough attention from her father, does she? And her mother says, wow, how'd you know that? And I said, because it's pretty obvious.
Yeah.
She seeks attention. So her inability to focus and concentrate is because she's not getting the attention. She's not getting the approval, the acceptance, the recognition, the validation, the affirmation, the support, the encouragement, the praise, and, as you put it probably most succinctly, the discipline.
Yep.
So here is the other question I want to ask you, because you talked about how all of these drugs have become almost like an industry in themselves. They're all interwoven between the field of psychiatry, the companies, and even the journals and the buildings. What about the FDA? Why doesn't the FDA intervene? If you're telling me there are no real scientific studies to even prove that there's a chemical imbalance, and now you're citing studies that are showing the dangers of these drugs.
Well, the FDA is doing the opposite of intervening on the side of science. The FDA gives its imprimatur, its official government approval, to the idea of giving drugs for emotional problems and even giving shock treatment for emotional problems. So the FDA is behind this viewpoint. It's a matter of the power of the psychopharmaceutical complex. It is probably, undoubtedly, the wealthiest, most powerful lobbying complex in Washington, D.C. As a result, the people who work for the FDA are trying to please the drug companies, literally trying to please them as best they can until they just absolutely have to draw the line on something. And all of the FDA's advisory panels are made up almost entirely of people who literally work for drug companies, not in their buildings, but work for them by doing research for them, doing consultations for them, giving speeches for them, writing papers for them, and so on and so forth. So the FDA over the years has really gone from sort of a weak watchdog to a house pet of the drug industry. It's ineffective. For example, recently it finally came around to admitting that antidepressants cause suicidality. But even then it tried to parse it and say, well, we know this in children and young adults. Well, since when does an adverse effect affect children and young adults, and at what age do you not be a young adult anymore? But I had been describing the suicidality produced by these drugs as early as 1991. And it took the FDA till 2004 to begin to acknowledge it. So, and our FDA is actually, used to be the premier drug monitoring agency, is falling behind, because it was actually Great Britain that first began to hold accountable the manufacturers of the antidepressants causing suicidality.
Now, I'm still hopeful that, as in the case of what happened with the tobacco industry, that there's still the chance that things could change, and hopefully that might happen soon. But nonetheless, if we look at the genesis of drugs in America, why is America the most medicated nation in the world? Why isn't it other countries, Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and other advanced nations?
Well, I don't have a complete answer to that, and it's obviously a question that goes way beyond psychiatric expertise into what you know, all of civilization. But a big chunk of it is marketing. The marketing starts in America. I can tell by what countries are phoning me to do radio and television interviews. I can tell where the marketing has moved. So, for example, initially almost all the stimulants were being used in the U.S. and then the U.S. and Canada. And for a time, not long ago, sometime before 2000, 90% of the world's Ritalin was being used in the U.S. Well, the market gets saturated, and then it begins to move, and it moved next to England and Australia, which were the English-speaking countries, and to Germany, because it also has a so-called advanced mental health concepts over there. So it starts where the marketing hits the strongest and spreads out, and in fact doesn't get to the so-called underdeveloped nations until much later, and often doesn't get into the poverty areas of the U.S., in West Virginia or in the inner cities, until much later as well. Another part of it is this has been sold on a very high intellectual level with these fake concepts, and that has appealed to the opinion leaders in the opinion-leading nations. And I think that's another way that America has become more deeply ensnared. But it's a complex question. I certainly don't have all the answers to it.
Well, from my perspective, I would say that probably the key factor has been the decision to allow drug companies to advertise, which I believe it only happens in the U.S. and New Zealand, correct?
Yes. I'm not sure which countries allow it, but it's very unusual. It's not allowed in most places. It's direct-to-consumer advertising, as it's called. But the problem began, I don't think that's a huge part of the problem. It's part of it. I mean, Prozac was the best-selling drug in the world before direct-to-consumer advertising. So it already was selling in the several, you know.
But Dr. Bregan, in terms of the total number of antidepressants that have been prescribed to people, the numbers have doubled in the time. And I think it happened under the Clinton regime that it was approved for drug companies to advertise and market their products, at which point the numbers just skyrocketed in terms of prescriptions of antidepressants. Because what really annoys me, as someone that works with people and tries to help people through their problems and help them to change their thoughts, their feelings, their perspectives, their beliefs, is to watch a commercial where suddenly it says, are you having a problem sleeping at night? Are you tossing and turning? You might have restless leg syndrome. Well, any intelligent person knows that if you're under a lot of stress, you're going to find it hard to sleep at night. And yes, you're going to be kicking the sheets and tossing and turning. That doesn't mean that there's something wrong in your brain. It means you need to deal with the problems that are happening during your waking hours. But we've now gone to the point, as you said, that it's true, we look for a quick solution. I call it instant gratification. But nonetheless, we look for a quick way out. Instead of dealing with the cause and the problem, we just want to deal with the symptoms, which never solves anything, because even if the drugs weren't damaging us to the extent that they are, which you're telling us right now, the problem is that the cause of these symptoms doesn't go away, and so it just creates other symptoms. And I think that is a huge danger in itself, because we have a two-pronged problem. The very cause that led you or me or anyone to go to the office of a psychiatrist and say, I need help, or a psychologist. And then the second thing is, well, now you're giving me drugs, and now I'm screwed. Now I've got more problems than before. I want to talk a little bit, though, about your experience with the pharmaceuticals, because with all due respect, I'm shocked that you're still around based on your history of how you've tackled some of these companies head on. And I'm sure, if I can ask this question respectfully, have you not received death threats?
Well, I don't want to get into any of that other than to say that anyone who's in the public limelight and who takes on billion-dollar industries is going to have to face, the whole range of threats. I think more interesting is that I have survived and I've had a good life, and while it is hazardous to speak truth to power, it's a good life for anyone who wants to have a somewhat overly exciting time on Earth.
Well, and I know that you're happily married and you have a lot of satisfaction and fulfillment within your relationship, which makes you a great role model for a lot of people. But I'm curious about some of the cases, because right at the beginning, I even used the terms lobotomy and psychosurgery. And I thought to myself, you know, we've bandied around the word lobotomy for many years, but was there a time in medicine when they actually removed parts of the brain, or here in America, did surgery in the hope of changing the way you think and feel?
Well, it's, first of all, it still goes on. I'll give you a brief history. And in 1936, a Portuguese surgeon started cutting up, actually poisoning. He put holes in the brains of mental patients in the state's mental hospital and pour poison in. And he found that these patients became much more docile and manageable. And then the treatment was usually popularized by a fellow named Walter Freeman in the U.S. during the 1950s, 40s and 50s. And Freeman actually developed the method of slipping an ice pick around the eyeball, which you can do apparently without injuring the eye, and knocking it through the thin wall of bone behind the eye and swishing it around. A blind ice pick, literally an ice pick, by the way, blind ice pick lobotomies. He did about 5,000 lobotomies, 40 or 50,000 were done. Then it, with the advent of the neuroleptic drugs, particularly Thorazine, the first one of them, Thorazine, you know, the mental patient populations in the state hospitals were subdued with drugs, and that looked a lot more medical and neater, and so that replaced to a great extent psychosurgery. Then in the early 70s, I found out that psychosurgery was coming back all over the world, including the U.S. and North America, with dozens of projects. And that's the moment that I really became a serious reformer, because I decided I wasn't going to sit back. I was going to become the first physician to stand up in a public way against lobotomy and not let it come back in full force. And I
Use an example of psychosurgery?
Well, what they were doing in the early 70s was the full range. They were doing old-fashioned lobotomies where they would open the skull, lift up the frontal lobes, and slice the connections that come up on the underside of the frontal lobes to the front of the brain, effectively deactivating the highest centers of emotion, feeling, and thinking, and producing a more indifferent, docile, and easier to manage and less complaining human being. But then they also began to do things like implant radium seeds in those areas. I mean, this is just coarse experimentation. And then finally, boring holes in the head, dropping electrodes down, stimulating the brain with the tips of the electrodes, then heating up the electrodes and burning holes in the brain. I go into this history fairly amount in on my website, Breggin.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com, has a section on psychosurgery. I actually spent 2 or 3 years of my life stopping the return of lobotomy and psychosurgery. It's one of the things I'm most proud of. Before I was done, almost every project, the United States, North America, and most of them in Europe, were done with. They gave up under the attack of legal suits, legislation, public protests, and so on. I'd go to the country or the state or, you know, and just give talks on the radio, and I really put a lot of energy into it.
Well, I applaud you, and may I add that when you say you did this, this involved court cases where you testified. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, there were a number of court cases, and in the beginning we lost them, but just bringing suits against these Harvard doctors, one in particular named Ballantyne, caused him to have to stop doing the surgery. But the juries wouldn't find in Boston against a Harvard doctor at that point. A malpractice suit was brought against some doctors I was very critical of. I didn't participate against them, Mark and Irvin. But that also shut down their surgery, even though the suit wasn't won. I managed to get Congress to cut off federal funding to some of the surgeons. And then we've had two suits that were important victories. In 1973, in a famous case, and again, it's on my website, Breggin.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N, we stopped a psychosurgical experimental series in Michigan State Hospitals, and the court wrote an opinion that read like my testimony, and that stopped all psychosurgery in the state hospitals, the VA, the government, All agencies of governments in the U.S. stopped doing them after that decision in the Kamowitz case, it's called. And then just about 2 years ago, we had a malpractice suit against the Cleveland Clinic for putting several holes in the head of an old lady and ruining her totally. And that caused the Cleveland Clinic to stop doing them. It was a $7 million verdict. You can find that on my website, too. And then now there are just two places that are doing it that we know of. I think there are other places hiding. But Harvard and Brown are still doing psychosurgery. They, you know, they try to make it look very scientific, and they, you know, they kind of admit that it's somewhat experimental, and they try to, you know, have experimental controls over it and so on and so forth. But it's died down considerably. But see, if you think about a profession where no one ever openly protested lobotomy until I came along, then you realize, well, there's some secret here. And I believe the secret is that all psychiatric treatments harm the brain and disable the brain, whether it's drugs or shock treatment or lobotomy. And so to attack lobotomy is to attack the principle of biological psychiatric treatment, which is that it disables the brain.
You've talked about the damage long-term that these drugs can do to the brain, and in some cases it's permanent. What does it do to you whilst you are on them? Because I'm gathering that it basically deadens your senses.
Well, the basic thing that happens whenever you disrupt brain function is that the subtlest human functions are impaired. And one of the most subtle human functions is self-perception. So if a person on a psychiatric drug says they're improved, it doesn't mean they are improved. It may mean they're emotionally blunted and don't realize it. It might mean they're a little high and don't realize it. Or it might be they're getting a placebo effect. They, you know, just the hope of being helped has helped them. So the drugs do what I call spellbinding, medication spellbinding. You don't perceive their adverse effects. If you feel bad from the drug, you don't notice the drug. Instead, you get angry at your wife, or you get suicidal without realizing what's going on. Just like somebody who's drinking too much will get angry and violent when they never would when they weren't drinking, and they'll blame it not on the drinking but on the person they're attacking. And in the extreme, people do really bizarre things on psychiatric drugs. That's what medication madness documents in one case after another.
You're talking about violence.
Well, violence, yeah, murder, and school shootings, going postal, theft, all kinds of different things, and then more subtle things, ruined marriage, ruined work careers, and children injured, and so on. Ultimately, though, I think the long-term exposure to most drugs does what you were suggesting. It dulls. People become less of themselves, less alert, less sharp, less able to multitask, less able to feel spiritually and lovingly. That, I think, is probably what the most lasting effects of any kind of injury to the brain are, and drugs become an injury to the brain.
Now, it's very interesting, and it amazes me that you're saying this, because one of my clients, by the name of Kathy Vallone, was diagnosed with depression, and then as a result, she was put on medication. And they changed her medication over about 7 years, 11 times. Because each time that they put on the medication, she'd go back and say, well, look, I've got this symptom now and this symptom, and my symptoms are getting worse. And they'd say, well, that's your depression getting worse. And they'd put on another drug. So they were basically just testing with her. But here's the point. Just the way you said, she, not only did she have all sorts of other consequences and side effects where she lost sex drive, she lost appreciation for music, for nature, for beauty, for art, her senses deadened, but she talked about having no spiritual connection, and she talked about not feeling like she was herself, not feeling like she's Kathy.
Well, exactly. Exactly.
And I don't think that's the key point. In wrapping up, I just want to ask quickly about the way that pharmaceuticals approach this. Could you tell me briefly about the, I think it's the Wesenbrecher case?
That's also on my website, Bregan.com, and it's also, oh, the most detailed description of the Wesenbrecher case is in the new book, Medication Madness. But basically, there were several hundred trials, cases being brought against Eli Lilly in the 90s for murder, mayhem, suicide caused by Prozac. And I was the chief scientific investigator for all the cases. The cases have been combined for the purpose of having one person be able to evaluate the science for all the lawyers. And when the first case came to be, the lawyer broke with his colleagues and fixed the trial with the drug company. So they had a fake trial. And I was stuck trying to figure out what's going on. I'm trying to testify. My own lawyer didn't want me to testify well, at least. Lily doesn't want me to testify well. I had the feeling I was the only honest, me and the judge were the only honest ones in the courtroom, because they actually had an agreement to throw the trial so that a lot of money would be given to the people who were injured, and Lily would secretly, and Lily would get a victory from the jury. Even so, Lily barely won the trial by 9-3, and then the judge found out that the trial had been fixed, and he actually canceled the verdict. Now,
well,
the American press loudly announced the original victory and didn't mention it at all when the judge, a couple of years later, went through the process of nullifying the trial. So it's a story of just how thoroughly a company like Eli Lilly can manipulate the media and the legal system. I was stuck in the middle of it, and it took me a long time to figure out what was going on.
Well, Dr. Bregan, I know that you and I agree on one very important key, that the answer starts inside. And as I mentioned with my client, Kathy Ballone, I'm assisting her in writing a book, not only about her story, but helping to give people advice and guidance, one, in giving them choices about whether they need to take these drugs, two, about the dangers of withdrawal, knowing how to very safely and carefully withdraw from these drugs. I know you talk about that on your website.
My book, Medication Madness, also has a chapter on how to withdraw from drugs. Go ahead. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's a very important point. You're right. And in the book that Kathy's writing, The Answers Inside, she refers to a lot of my work in which I help people to take a completely different approach to their problems, dealing first with the cause and then the symptoms. What is your overall advice to people on two levels? One, who are suffering from depression, and two, who might already be on drugs?
I can't give any really blanket advice in a general way, because, you know, people have their own problems, and I don't know what their particular problems are. But I advocate that people avoid starting psychiatric drugs if they can, because there are so many risks and hazards to them, and their efficacy is often much in doubt. Depression is a matter of hopelessness, feeling hopeless and despairing and desperate, and the extreme being paralyzed. Well, these are feelings, these are emotions, and as you pointed out, they start inside. They often relate to terrible outside events, which then become embedded inside of us. And human beings can really overcome depression through so many methods, not just therapy and counseling, but religion. People have overcome it by getting into exercise programs. People have overcome it by falling in love. People have changed their lives to overcome depression. It's a matter of finding a way to love life again, to love life again, to be involved in life. That's a process that is as big as life itself. Drugs aren't going to help that in the long run. Now, if you're on psychiatric drugs, that's entirely up to you as to what to do, but I want you to be informed. Medication Madness tries to inform you about the hazards of these drugs. If you decide you want to come off, you have to be very cautious, because people can, they come off too quickly. Some of these drugs will produce seizures. Some will produce a drop in blood pressure. And almost all of them will produce an emotional negative reaction during withdrawal. So you have to be very careful and cautious and thoughtful about how you go about withdrawing from the psychiatric drugs.
Well, Dr. Bregan, I respect, honor, and applaud not just the work you're doing, but the work you've been doing for so many years, and particularly your new book, Medication Madness, which is out now, and I'm guessing that people can get it from your website as well as Amazon and other bookstores. And your website is Bregan.com, Bregin.com. Dr. Peter Bregan, I thank you very much, and as I say, I wish you the very best with your continued work.
Thank you very much.